finally this morning, we're going to talk about the dawn of photography in Aotearoa. The arrival of it here in 1848 was more about business than art. Pretty cumbersome kit, meaning photographers needed carriages or horses to lug their gear across unsealed roads to sell their wares. And these early images, of course, provide a valuable insight into the country's colonial era, with stunning portraits and landscapes now being presented in a new book entitled A Different Light, First Photographs of Aotearoa. It's edited by Catherine Hammond and Sean Higgins, and the book pulls together the extraordinary and extensive photographic collections of three major research libraries. It's also being celebrated with the travelling exhibition, and Sean Higgins is with us now to talk about it. Kia ora, good morning.
Kia ora.
Thank you for being with us today. I should also say there is a gallery of images on our website, and I think we might talk through a few of those with you, Sean, if that's possible. But first of all, tell us about the dawn of photography here. What was it? What was its journey to Aotearoa like, and how did photography land here?
Well, the earliest evidence that we have of a camera being used here is in 1848. A man called Newland was in the Bay of Islands, and he photographed Māori using daguerreotype technology, one of the early forms of photography. And that coincides with a journey of probably about a decade or so from its inception in France, and it spread from France around the world like wildfire, pretty much the same speed everywhere, which is quite interesting. And this is really the exciting thing about photography, is that it suddenly appears, it's new to everybody. It's this strange thing that people have never seen before, never seen themselves perhaps in that way.
Yeah, absolutely. And what is the first image that we know of that was taken here?
So the first surviving image, those 1848 ones, we haven't found any surviving, and nothing from 49. But we do have, in 1852, quite a number of photographs that survive. And when I say quite a number, I mean dozens, when there should be thousands. So that's one of the funny things to begin with. But the first one that we can authenticate is a rather bewildered man. He looks bewildered. His name is Edward Catchpole, and he sat in Wellington in 1852 in April for a daguerreotype. He actually looks like a confused first-time Tinder user. It's quite a funny sort of portrait, but you have to put yourself in his shoes and remember that he's never seen a camera before. He has no concept of what this is. And he's had to sit for probably up to about 45 seconds, which is not comfortable.
Yes, that was the thing with very early photography, wasn't it? That people had to stay so still, which is why, or is that why, do you think, that so many people look quite stern and quite serious in these early pictures?
Yes, so there's the one side where when we look at all these photographs, we think, gosh, must have been pretty miserable back then. But it is mostly because of the form of the long exposure. Even a few seconds today is long enough to make people uncomfortable, let alone going for tens of seconds. And as the technology changes, this does get faster, and it does seem to be one of the things that made people able to loosen up a little over time. But certainly this early period, they keep the pose. And the other thing that often comes up that is overlooked is dentistry was not very good back then. So they don't tend to want to have a big grin and show their mouth. In fact, they say prunes. The photographer would tell you, say prunes, to keep you in a nice kind of consistent pose with what they were looking for. So there's a little bit of that as well.
So prunes, not cheese.
Prunes, not cheese.
Prunes, not cheese. Right. Of course, there are lots of pictures of people. If we can talk through a few of those. And actually, the one on the front cover, I absolutely love. It is of a baby wearing the most extraordinary kind of dress, and I don't know if it's a hood or some kind of hat, sitting on an old sort of antique, what we think of now as an antique chair, and a woman crouched behind that you can't completely see. What's that one about?
So what's happening there is something that they're kind of dubbed the hidden mother. And what you're seeing is somebody attempting to deal with that long exposure I mentioned. Slightly shorter than the daguerreotype, but still long enough that you don't want a small infant sitting unattended for too long, lest they topple over. So the mother behind is crouching behind the chair in a way, trying to be there, hold, perhaps even sometimes they actually have their hands coming through a cloth, holding the baby steady. There's quite a few of these in existence, and there's even some where they're completely covered in a cloth or a shroud so that they're almost invisible, but they are there holding these babies steady.
Amazing.
And this is how you get a baby portrait.
This is how you get a baby portrait. With the some of the pictures, as you're looking through, what for you were some of the real standouts?
Well, one of the things that I was very fortunate to see across this project was looking across three collections, three very large collections. So I was quite impressed with just the ability to look at these photographs that have come from multiple locations all over Aotearoa and get a sense of what's out there. But I think one of the standouts for me has to be the mammoth plates of the pink and white terraces, simply because of the scale. We do have very tiny photographs, and then yet that's contrasted with very large photographs at a time where essentially to enlarge a photograph you've got to get a bigger camera and a bigger negative. And these negatives are probably about 50 centimetres across, and if you think about a piece of glass required that size being taken to somewhere like the pink and white terraces, that's where your imagination starts to go wild, that logistics thing that we were talking about in the introduction.
Yeah.
The idea that somebody has carried, say, 20 of these and a camera that size up to a place like the pink and white terraces. I like to call it the giant megapixel camera of the time.
It really is. Because how big would the camera itself have been if that's how big your glass plates are?
At least as big, and then with a little bit of wood housing around the edge, the contracting bellows, the lens on the front, and the tripod to hold that monstrosity. So all of these things would have had to have been either carried or put on a horse and transported to the location. And the other thing about this time is that you had to have your darkroom with you as well, usually a small tent or a cart, because you had to process the negative after taking it straight away. You couldn't take it home and do it later. So you've got to have some chemicals and light-safe environment to work after you take the photograph.
Oh, so where do you think these photographs would have been developed?
Probably in a small tent nearby, and then they would have washed the plates in the waters of the terraces.
That's extraordinary. It's like looking back in time. Really extraordinary. So with these photographs, and I suppose with your particular chapter that you put together, it's about the Auckland province's journey of photographic technology. What sorts of things did you unearth and particularly enjoy looking through with that?
Well, firstly, I'll for people listening, I'll clarify the Auckland province in the 19th century is the top half of the entire North Island, which is quite amusing when you consider how it progressively shrinks over time. So that gave me an area all the way across, which is why I've got the pink and white terraces, for example. But some of the standouts to me were the smaller things. For example, there's some ferrotype gems that I talk about, which are about the size of your thumbnail. These are tiny, tiny little photographs. And as I look through collections and find these, you seem to find more of these little pieces of iron they are. And it starts to suggest to you just how people adopted this almost like carnival style in the States. It was actually used in carnivals all the time as this ready-made, cheap, affordable photograph. And you contrast that with the early daguerreotypes and ambrotypes that were very expensive. Probably the most beautiful one of those that I've seen is a couple called the Allisons, Alexander Allison and Jane Allison. And Jane sits next to him on the left, and she and him are together in a daguerreotype, which is quite rare, and it's also a large daguerreotype for the time, probably well beyond what you would expect carpenter and shipwright to be able to afford. And their arms are one over the other. And it kind of breaks that boundary, if you like, that pose and that long exposure put on them. Their faces don't look happy, but that's because they're sitting for many, many seconds. but they are somehow bound together nonetheless. And even their jewellery is detailed in gold, just to kind of show that they're real.
Yes, there's a closeness in that photograph that you often don't get from couples from that time.
Yeah, and I find that enchanting, that one, they've actually got this photograph, and they're not missionaries or people that necessarily had considerable wealth, but that they are together, and that's what I like.
What about the first photographs or early photographs that were taken of Māori? How did that work?
So there's actually the very first photographs of all taken in Aotearoa were Māori, so that's the first context. And a considerable number of the photographs throughout the collections that we looked at and throughout the history of photography are Māori. They feature prominently. Early on, I think there's a two-way process where Māori themselves are actively engaged with the camera and with photography, but there's also this idea that develops over time that Māori are a collectible in their own right. And particularly you see this in when you get something called the carte de visite, a small, quite portable, it's about the size of a business card. And when you see these things start to come along and be mass-produced, again, they can do two things. On the one hand, King Tawhia definitely embraced this technology as a way to spread his image around Aotearoa and the world. So he went around studios until he found a studio that could produce the number that he wanted. And he went to a studio of Elizabeth Pullman, one of the few women practicing her own studio at that time and very early. And she had a number of different formats and outputs. The page in the book actually shows all three of those together. And to Tawhia, I think this was the idea that he could put his image out there and spread it to the world. So he sat for that portrait.
But also, did that mean that Māori was sort of viewed in a somewhat disconnected way sometimes through the lens?
Yeah, so whilst Tawhia certainly acted in his own interest in that photography session, the large number of these small Māori carte de visites are actually entirely different. They are often anonymous sitters. We know from actually a trial involving that Tawhia image, which was protected by copyright, somebody broke that, and at that trial they actually admitted that there were no pecuniary measures in those contexts, which means they were not paid. So if you imagine these anonymous sitters and surmise that they probably weren't paid, perhaps they were given a photograph, but did they realise that their photograph would be retained by the studio and then sold to collectors who would put that in their albums and collect them like trading cards? And this is, and even term them Māori celebrities. So this is the context where it completely flips, and instead of this being for the benefit of Māori, this is actually the complete opposite. It's a collectible commodity where studios are boasting that they have the most Māori portraits for sale.
Mm.
And this is predominantly for a Pākehā collector audience.
So to what extent do you think photography was, for a time, sort of a tool of colonisation?
I would say ongoing. It certainly was. There, if you take the early survey photography, for example, the very purpose of those surveys, so I'm talking about 1859 when Ferdinand Hochstetter did his geological survey, that government survey essentially was in order to survey the Auckland province to see what's there. That's a very obvious act of colonisation, that you are looking to see what's out there and actually categorising it. And a photographer called Bruno Hamel accompanied him. His photographs are in the book. And he travelled with a camera documenting what he saw. So again, the photographic record as a document of, well, evidence of these things, and evidence can have multiple perspectives. In this context, it certainly provides information that could then be used later.
Mm. This does, of course, mean that there are some early pictures of what the landscape looked like as well, and what sort of alteration and development can you trace across some of those early photographs of how quickly various centres sprung up or didn't?
I think the most obvious thing that happens in the photography is they use photography as a kind of advertisement to the world, particularly to the United Kingdom, to try to pull people out here. And what that does is it shows all of the developments. These pictures have things that would horrify a lot of people today, massive reclamation, such as the Auckland waterfront or the Wellington waterfront, where they're literally changing the landscape and building land where there was harbour or where there was a bay. And all of these developments are seen in a positive way, or advertised certainly in a positive way, as a developing place, this place that you want to come because, look, we're making huge progress on ports and things like that.
It's somewhat different these days.
It is, absolutely. It's such a contrast. When you go around these places today and you think, gosh, there was a hill here. You know, there's an image from Dunedin of Bell Hill, for example, being taken away with the church in the background that you can still see today. And this is to the octagon. This is literally making the space for the octagon. So all of our cities, I think, have this feature that we've actually removed something from the natural landscape that was there in order to create them.
Although we think of photography always as being black and white in the early days, there was a way of getting colour.
Yeah, so there's two. I do have a saying I like to say in there that it's interesting to me, and that's actually why the book looks the way it does. So we tend to think of black and white, but actually it's so many tones and shades of sepia, and all the rich little differences in the photographs is why we've gone to so much effort to show them that way in the book. So firstly, it's not black and white, it's actually a world of colour in monochrome, if you like, different tones. And then on top of that, they had ways of colouring photographs, but they weren't the colour that we know today. So what they would do was they would add colour, and I mentioned the jewellery on the Ellisons was gold. There's also the ability to add blue details or pink details, pink rosy cheeks, for example. And as we progress through time, they get a bit more bold and move towards painting entire photographs. And so eventually you reach the situation where you'll be looking, and some of the collections actually have these in them. And I know from some of them in our collection that they were originally catalogued as paintings, and it wasn't known they were photographs until we took a bit of a closer look and thought, oh, what's underneath here? And it seems that these photographs have been painted.
Fantastic. Well, look, thank you very much for coming on Saturday morning and telling us about that. Sean Higgins there. He is one of the editors of a new book entitled A Different Light, First Photographs of Aotearoa. It's a really beautiful book as well.